Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to this press conference. My name is Kathy Spangler, and I'm the Director of Communications for the Diocese of Buffalo. I'd like to thank our hosts, Father Chuck Sliss, and the staff here at the Cathedral for hosting us this afternoon. I'd like to introduce you to members of our staff who are here today. First and foremost, of course, Bishop Richard Malone, the Bishop of the Diocese of Buffalo, Bishop Edward Gross, the Auxiliary Bishop and Vicar General, Sister Regina Murphy, our Chancellor, Father Peter Corrales, our Vicar General and Moderator of the Curia, and Stephen Halter, who is out there. He's the Director of our Office of Professional Responsibility. We will start with an opening statement from Bishop, and following that, we'll open it up to questions. I'd like to ask each of you to start with one question, and if our time allows, we will absolutely go another round. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Bishop Malone.
Thank you, Kathy. Very much. Thank you all for coming. It always seems like short notice when we call upon you, and I'm grateful for that, for coming. The reason for the press conference, of course, is the taping of confidential senior staff meetings by my former priest secretary and vice chancellor of the diocese related to ongoing investigations of several individuals. Now, this relates to a very, very complex and convoluted matter that I want to explain to you personally. And I'm using notes more than I ordinarily would because the situation can be very confusing, and I don't want to confuse it any worse than it may already be. First of all, let me explain the key persons involved in this whole situation. First of all is Matthew Bojanowski. I think he usually says Bojanowski, a former seminarian until very recently at Christ the King Seminary in the pre-theology program. That's the very first year or two of their formation. He sent in a letter with several concerns about Father Jeffrey Nowak, and that letter arrived on the 28th day of January of this year, and it went to the Office of Professional Responsibility, where investigations ensue on the 8th of February. That's when the process began to move forward. This was about primarily claims of sexual harassment and violation of the seal of confession. You know, in the Catholic Church, it's a very strong principle that no priest can ever, under any circumstances, even danger of death, reveal what is told to him in the sacrament of penance when people go to confession. To this date, that remains unproven. You cannot canonically simply accuse someone of violation of the seal of confession, which is a very serious charge, without giving some indication. Doesn't have to reveal a particular sin confessed, but some indication. Was something said? Did something happen that's a direct result? And two canonists I've consulted have assured me that unless there's something indicated to validate the claim, then the claim really does not hold much credibility. But we continue to look at all of this. We continue to look at it. It's so important. So Mr. Bojanowski participated in an initial interview with Mr. Steve Halter early in the spring, and he has been invited to participate in further investigation to explore some of the questions so as to provide specific details to his claims. In particular, how was the seal of confession violated? It's a very serious concern, which I would take very seriously. And to date, he has not participated in those further invitations to bring clarity. Hopefully, he might in the future. The second individual is Father Jeffrey Nowak. He is pastor of Our Lady Help of Christians Parish in Cheektowaga, currently on administrative leave. And the claims were made against him by Matthew Bojanowski. And during the that part of the investigation, a question arose about the existence of a letter, and I'll talk about that a little further on, a letter he had in his possession. I'm going to come back to it, so don't be frustrated that I'm not dealing with it. And so Father Nowak was asked in December for this letter, which purportedly he had in his possession, and we found out eventually he did. But he lied to me when I met with him about that and said no, he no longer had that letter. Apparently, he had taken a picture of the letter on his phone and then said he had deleted it. So all of these things and others went to the Office of Professional Responsibility that I established last year. Father Nowak was interviewed for 3 days in May for over 6 hours about all of these kinds of things. And then in that context, he finally produced the letter that he told me he no longer possessed. It was determined then that Father Nowak needed to go for a sort of a behavioral assessment. We have several institutes that we call upon to send people who we think need some kind of evaluative process to help us decide what we can do to help those folks move forward. Sometimes they'll ask them after a few days of, the evaluation, they'll ask them to stay longer for treatment. Sometimes that happens, sometimes it does not. So he was removed from ministry until he would go for that assessment. He first agreed to do that in July to a place called the St. Luke Institute, which has been around for many, many years, and he did not comply. He took several days, took us several days to get in touch with him. So in the beginning of August, I don't mean to confuse you with all these dates, but the timeline is important. At the beginning of August, Father Nowak said he would go, and then he backed out on that. Then he was given a third opportunity to go for assessment on the 25th of August. And once again, for a third time, he did not go, and that is when I put him on administrative leave, which means he cannot at this time function or present himself as a priest. So the issues here are concerns for the seal of confession, which we'll continue to try and understand more carefully, perhaps boundary issues and or other kinds of inappropriate behavior, all of these kinds of things. And an assessment, we feel, it's been our experience, an assessment, especially the ones done these days, would hopefully reveal if he or any person was dealing with relationship issues, which would then help us to determine how to work with Father moving forward. So that's person number two, and here comes person number three. And that is Father Richard Bernat, who's a priest of the Diocese of Buffalo, came to us from Poland, and for the past 6 years has been the secretary to me, the priest, what we call the priest secretary to the bishop, and also vice chancellor. Being vice chancellor, Sister Regina Murphy is the chancellor, and Father was the vice chancellor. Currently, he is on not administrative leave, but a personal leave of absence, which any priest can be asked to consider or can request for himself. Matthew Bojanowski developed a friendship with Father Richard while Matthew was discerning himself going into the seminary during that period a few years ago. And a key piece here of this whole scenario is that Father Richard composed a letter to Matthew in 2016. And that letter has come to light and is, we know, circulating among some of you in the media and in our community. How it got out there like that is a mystery to us, but we know it did. The content of that letter, if you've seen it, is a bit concerning. And that is why I suggested that Father Richard should go on a personal leave of absence for a while. And the purpose of that, in my own thoughts, was to provide him some time apart from his work with me. His work with me was really all-encompassing in so many, many ways. So the issue here is the letter from Father Richard to Matthew. And I do have to say, without focusing on this myself, Father Richard's actions, for whatever reason, in providing those tapes of what are meant to be the highest level of confidential, sensitive discussions among my senior team, This really is a serious breach of confidentiality for someone to do that. And Father is a member of the Diocesan Curia, which means the highest level of leadership with me, and has actually broken church law in doing that. Now, how are these persons involved? Let me give you context now. Father Nowak was the parochial vicar previously at St. John Vianney Parish, where he, in Orchard Park, where he met Matthew. Matthew's family belongs to that parish, I believe. And Father Nowak began mentoring Matthew, who was a discerning a vocation then to the priesthood. And that developed into what appeared to be a pretty deep friendship between the two of them. And Matthew then later met Father Richard Bernat. Okay? And as that relationship developed with Father Richard and Matthew, Matthew's relationship with Father Nowak cooled, you might say. That's probably a good word for it. And this was disturbing to Father Nowak. You see the complexity of this whole thing. And that letter was sent, Father Nowak secretly photographed that letter that he found in Matthew's apartment in Boston when he was visiting there. This is all several years ago. The letter was sent by Father Richard Bernat to Matthew. And Matthew later wrote to me accusing Father Nowak of harassment and several other allegations that I've already mentioned. I'm getting toward the end here, then it's your time with your questions. Now, Father Richard has served as my personal secretary, as well as vice chancellor of the diocese, and a member of my senior staff since the time he arrived here. Not arrived here in the States, but arrived in my office. So his release of information from a very sensitive and always very confidential senior discussion where we talk about the most sensitive matters, I have to say, was truly a disappointment to me, as well as a breach of his canonical obligations at his level in the work of the diocese. He was recently issued a canonical warning and asked to take a personal leave of absence in order to take some time to discern. He was still allowed to celebrate Mass. I did not suspend that or anything. Until last week, I think he was still living in the residence. I didn't see much of them, but he was there. He and I had lived together at Oakland Place, and then we sold Oakland Place to get money for the Victims Fund. We leased the old convent at St. Stan's Parish in the Broadway Fillmore District, and we both lived there in that house. And we both prayed together many, many days and enjoyed much conversation together during all of that time. So the relationship of these three men is very complicated. They have leveled, in one way or another, accusations among themselves, which needed intense investigation. And as I say, that investigation continues. None of the individuals have been totally forthcoming or cooperative. And that's one of the reasons that this thing has taken as long as it has, plus all the other investigations we've been doing during this past year of allegations of abuse of children, of minors. We had many of those cases, as you know, during the past year. Now, this compromising letter, as some have called it, from Father Richard to Matthew was alluded to by several people, but when I asked to see it, as I mentioned, I was told by Father Nowak that his lawyer had it. And then, after 2 months, Father Nowak finally gave us that letter. And the letter could be perceived as reflecting what you might call an inappropriate relationship between Matthew and Father Richard, as some have noted. I say that because I've heard that from several people, not people of my staff, but people, Catholics in the diocese. Matthew has accused Father Nowak of harassment, and Matthew sent me a letter, and it's just summary now, and emails that he had received from Father Nowak. And those were emails back and forth between the two of them, it should be noted. And those also could suggest that there was something inappropriate there going on the part of Father Nowak. So you see the remarkable complexity of this whole situation that we've been dealing with, and the time that's required for full and thorough investigation, which we have to do. We owe the individuals involved, whatever their part in the whole scene, we owe them a thorough and careful investigation according to the norms and protocols of church law and any other norms and law that would come into the picture. So that's really my little introduction here for you, and I'm happy to answer the best I can any of your questions.
Bishop, with all due respect, you have not addressed what was heard in those audio files, and that you referred to Nowak as a sick puppy, as dangerous, and people now feel that you have lied about the policy that you told the community you were following, that if someone had a credible accusation, that they would not be allowed to be in ministry, and yet he was. How do you respond to that?
Well, I understand the question, but there is a response to it, and I'm happy to have the chance to make that. First of all, you know, any of us who have had discussions in what we believe is a totally confidential environment with our closest colleagues, sometimes we'll use language that we would not use in public. For example, there was a lot of frustration in trying to sort out this thing with Father Nowak. And if you looked at some of the content that Matthew Bojanowski wrote to us about, that described some of the language and behavior of Father Nowak, you see it was very frustrating trying to get hold of all of that kind of a situation. So sick puppy was not a very, I was just getting frustrated. If I were talking to the media, I would say a man with some issues, you know? But when you're with people you meet with every week about these things, you can kind of let your frustration out, let your hair down, and not a word I would ordinarily use. And to say he was dangerous, I didn't mean that in the sense of someone who I thought had the potential or the risk to harm somebody, go out there and do some damage to someone. I was concerned, and I remember that, and my staff helped me to remember it even more clearly. We were concerned at that time about the effect that the letter that Father Nowak had, that was a letter from Father Richard to Matthew, could have in terms of possible scandal on people, on the diocese, if it would raise all kinds of questions. That's really what I meant by that word. It was not meant to suggest that this is a person who is a risk. So that's why he wasn't immediately removed and put on administrative leave.
So don't think he's a dangerous, possible abuser to others out there?
Well, I hope he's not, but I don't have indication that it's at that level. But that's why an evaluation by competent professionals is so important.
Michael, do you want
Bishop,
to, we'll kind
because
of take our
now
time.
There yeah. have been two members of your very innermost circle who have decided to go public with what it is that they know. Should the people of the Buffalo Diocese have questions about your judgment as to who you surround yourself with, and should they have further questions as to whether or not you're suitable to remain in the position that you are, Bishop of the Buffalo Diocese?
Thank you for the question. I understand where that would come from. First of all, I was very thoughtful and did lots of consultation in my choice of the two individuals you just referenced, one who had been my executive assistant and the other my priest, we call priest secretary. And in that job, he mostly responsible for logistics of my ministry and helping me with ceremonies and many, many other things like that. And both of these individuals came very highly recommended to me. And so I don't feel my judgment was faulty. Things showed up later that made me wonder what I had missed when we were doing the interviews and all of that. But no, I don't. And I also don't feel that that it's time for me to move on. I've said that from the beginning. As a woman said to me coming out of church last month, she said, Bishop, you know the things you need to do better. You've often mentioned that. But she said, please don't think you have to be the lightning rod for 50 or 60 years of bad behavior by priests that came before you ever got here. And I try to remember that, and I feel an obligation as the bishop of this diocese to do all the best I can, working with other people, including a lot of laity, to move us forward toward a restoration of trust.
Well, so Bishop, there's a growing even number of priests in your diocese who have lost faith in you, not to mention the rest of the diocese. How do you feel you can effectively lead the diocese right now?
How can you
effectively lead the diocese right now when even some of your priests don't have confidence in your leadership?
Well, you know, I can tell you from what I know, and I just held a meeting of most all of the priests last Wednesday, and there's much more, and you can ask, I can give you names of ones. I think the ones who would like to see me move on are truly the minority, and I know that's not wishful thinking because other priests have told me that. Priest told me just the other day, most of us are with you, Bishop. Seminarians tell me the same thing. Does it mean all of them are? No. But I feel very good with my priests. I'm very open and candid with them. Just like I'm doing Q&A with you folks today, I do that with my priests and my deacons and others in ministry. And I give them straightforward and honest answers. So if I felt like a majority of my clergy felt I could no longer properly lead the diocese with them, because a bishop does not lead by himself, or he's a poor leader, then I'd have to rethink my commitment.
Bishop, do you worry that by staying on as bishop, it's going to affect the finances of the diocese even more? We've been focusing, say, on the appeal every year that's been having its struggles. Less people are wanting to donate each week when they go to church. Do you worry that by staying on, it's going to affect even more than it has over the last couple of years?
Well, I have a concern about that, but we know that let me just back up for a minute. I want you to know that I fully understand the rage and the dismay and perhaps the incredulity and lack of trust that so many people in the community, not only Catholics, feel. And I may be a part of that because I'm the bishop currently, but it's a lot of it is the weight of decades of bad things that some priests did. And so I accept that. And I think if I can accept that and try to move on and try to work with the folks who are so committed to restoring trust and all of that, that we can turn this around. And sometimes, by the way, and I don't say this defensively, I hope I don't come across that way, but every single week, my office folks can tell you, I receive all kinds of letters and notes from people encouraging me and thanking me. So it's not as, there are those who'd like to ride me out of town, I get that. But there are lots of other people who actually say, and even at the listening sessions, thank me for hanging in there.
Bishop, you've already indicated that the most recent events don't really change your stance on possible resignation, but what about diocesan bankruptcy? What is your stance on that?
Well, the Child Victims Act, as you know, I'm sure, news people know all these things before I say them, but it applies to all 8 dioceses of New York State. And the bishops have frequent conference calls or meetings among ourselves. And we're all, I don't want to speak for all 8, but I know I'm not the only one right now who feels like I'm standing at a crossroads, analyzing where we are with our resources, because we've already spent over $18 million for the Independent Reconciliation and Compensation Program. We felt we couldn't do a part two of that, at least right now, because we needed to have funds left now to work with the Child Victims Act people who were so tragically hurt and abused over many, many decades. So the fact of the matter is that I have been in dialogue both with attorneys who would argue, and others who would argue for litigation. And to do that, of course, we have to know, because our resources are limited, we have some, but we have to know that we have insurance coverage for some of the periods when abuse happened. And that could be a challenge to work that out. I learned a whole new term recently. There's something called insurance archaeology, simply meaning even pastors are told there might have been a time when your parish had its own insurance instead of through the diocese. So go down into the basement, go up into the attic, and see whatever kind of insurance documentation you can find, because if you've had an abuse case there and the parish is being sued, there may be insurance coverage for that case during that season. So we're looking at litigation and at the possibility of bankruptcy, or Chapter 11 reorganization, as we like to use a euphemism for it, which is, as you know, a structure and strategy that helps the mission of the church to go forth securely. So we're right now, that's the honest truth, we're looking at both of those very, very closely and carefully. And I have not yet made a decision. There are people arguing both positions.
You've admitted that you are a controversial figure in the community and in the church. Don't you think that just your mere presence as the figurehead of, as the leader of the church in Buffalo, that would lead the church in the wrong direction with so much extremism on both sides in their opinion?
Another insightful question. That's a gauge, of course, I have to keep my eye on, any bishop does under any circumstances. But I still feel strong. I mean, I'm not a masochist. You know what I mean? I'm not a person who stays in something because I enjoy pain and all of that. I'm here because I feel an obligation as the one who was sent here to lead this diocese to carry on. And once again, if I thought that the majority of Catholic people in particular were calling for my resignation, that would be a different story. But I don't feel that. I go out to parishes and schools all the time for visits. I am always well received when I go. Who knows what some people's thoughts are sitting there in the pews that they don't articulate. But I do feel enough support, honestly, to continue on. I will be 75 in March of 2021. And it's on his 75th birthday that a bishop, by church law, must submit his resignation to the Pope. And the Pope can take as long as he wants to accept that resignation. So right now, I'm going a day at a time, and I'm trusting in my God, trusting in my own prayer, and in the good people around me. And we've been doing some, I think, very good initial work with the movement to restore trust, which is a strong call, not only to get through this crisis, but to reform the church, especially by more significant roles for lay women and lay men.
Speaking of the Pope, Christian Malone, what have you heard?
Of whom, I'm sorry, James?
Speaking of the Pope.
The Pope.
What have you heard from the Vatican on both your handling of child sex abuse cases and on these more recent adult cases?
Well, the Pope, they say the Pope frequently picks up the phone and calls people around the world, but I have not been the recipient of one of those calls. I've had no communications from the Pope at all.
Not necessarily the Pope of the Vatican.
Well, I keep in contact with the Apostolic Nuncio, who, as you know, is kind of like the Pope's ambassador in each country. I've had conversations with him. When something is brewing, I try to give, all with Cardinal Dolan, who is the Metropolitan Archbishop of New York, of the whole state, and keep them abreast of things and answer questions they have.
Have they said to you, you must stay?
No.
What
they've neither said you must stay nor you must leave. And so, and I know for sure they're not unaware, you know, of all the news around here. But so far, apparently, I like to think they are trusting in my goodwill and my intention and my capacity, working with other people to lead us forward.
Bishop Malone.
But if I get a call from the Pope, maybe I'll let you hear about that.
Bishop Malone, I'd like to reiterate the subject of transparency. You've been talking about that over and over again. By telling us this story of the three priests and reiterating their story, some of your critics say that this is more victim blaming and victim shaming, and you're doing it with sort of an arrogant tone as opposed to taking full responsibility of this for yourself by not removing him sooner from ministry.
Well, we didn't have it. I get where you're coming from. But we did not feel, you mean removing Father Nowak?
Yes.
We did not, well, we did ask him to step aside for a while at when we first were looking at these concerns that came to us from Matthew Boschanowski. But we did not feel, and you need to know that, as I mentioned, I think there were 3 days in May where over 6.5 hours of interview and discussion went on, led by Steve Halter and Bishop Grosch as the auxiliary bishop, with Father Nowak. And we decided it would be good for him to go for evaluation. Eventually, when he refused to go 3 times, I had had it. It's time to put him on leave. But we did not feel or discern before that time that it was necessary to put him on leave. He had not been accused of any kind of physical, like sexual contact or any of those kinds of things that would trigger something of that sort.
Well, Bishop, in January, the allegation was levied that Father Nowak had rummaged through Boschanowski's things, taken that letter. You acknowledged you subsequently found out he was in possession of that letter. How does that conduct not rise to the level of putting him on administrative leave?
Well, that's why eventually in this complex scenario, that is one, of course, of the several reasons when you started to add them over time that led us to the decision to put him in administrative leave. But the particular reason was so that he could go off for evaluation by objective professionals and explore any and all of those things, okay? And to see where is all that coming from and what does it mean for his future possibilities of ministry. So that's really the answer to that one.
Why wasn't Father Beer not sent for a similar assessment?
He has not been at this time. We shall see going forward what will happen. Once again, I am not aware at this time of any allegations of sexual impropriety between Father Richard and Matthew. None of that has come my way.
But he broke his vow of obedience to the bishop, did he not?
His promise of obedience?
To the bishop?
Father Richard?
Yes.
You mean in this case of releasing the documents?
Yes, sir.
Well, I suppose you could interpret it that way.
Isn't that a firing offense?
Well, there would be, it's not, you know, sometimes people think these things in the Catholic Church are all black and white, but they're not, there's loads of gray. And there are levels, huh? There are levels of gravity to these things. And at this point, it has not been my sense that it's time for Father Richard to be moving in that direction.
How did Father Richard explain the contents of the letter to you? I mean, I'm sure people here have read the letter.
You've seen it.
It seems to be a love letter.
Yeah. A lot of people have said that to me. Apparently, that it took us a long time to get that letter. Months. A lot of people out there, apparently, had seen that letter before I did. It was circulating around. And that is the report I heard, or the take I heard on that letter from a number of lay people who saw it, that it seemed like romantic in tone, it seemed like a love letter.
But Father Richard has not explained the letter or the contents of the letter to you?
He has explained it, but I think I'd go beyond where I should go to give his explanation. I think you need to ask him for that. It's his story, you know, and I don't feel comfortable revealing what he told me about that. But it's a very, Jay, it's a very legitimate question.
Was there disappointment or shame?
Excuse me?
From you, was there disappointment as the leader of the Catholic Church in this area? Disappointment or shame in his personal conduct?
Well, I was very surprised. You mean about sending that letter to Matthew? To Matthew. Yes, it did catch me by surprise, to tell you the truth. I mean, I had heard rumors about that sometime in the past that there was a letter, But obviously, you can't move on an even initial investigation about a letter and its contents until you have the letter, right? And so that's the kind of the story on that.
So is that why you wanted him to take the lead, though?
My reason for that was that I know the letter is out there. People are talking about it. I know that some of your organizations, some of your stations have that letter. And I just thought that while that is out there brewing, whatever it means, it might be a good thing for Father Richard just to step a bit apart from his work with me. As I mentioned before, it was not administrative leave. I asked him to consider doing that, and he did. He still is able to celebrate Mass, and which he does, and all of those types of things. But, excuse me, there was some water there. Thank you. So that's basically, I forget, where was I? That's so bright, I can't, who was I talking to? Over. I'm sorry. What is your name again?
Of course.
Yeah. So that's basically the story there. Did I miss anything in answering your question?
I think, I'm just trying to get an understanding of the purpose for asking him to take the lead. Was it because, obviously the church has strict rules when it comes to sexuality. Was it because you had concerns whether or not he was following those rules? Is that why you wanted him to leave your office?
Not really. No, that was not the reason. I thought with news that might be coming about that letter, it might be better for him and for the diocese, because he's very, very closely perceived as working with me, which he has done, and done very well for 6 years. We must have driven around thousands of miles in Western New York, going to parishes and confirmation ceremonies and all of that. We lived in the same residence for over 6 years. We always got along very, very well. Most evenings, if we were going to be in, which didn't happen too often because we have a lot of evening events, we would always meet around 5:20 in the afternoon, the two of us and any guests who were there, and we would have prayer together. Then we might have a glass of wine or something and then sit down for dinner and have a just regular conversation people would have. Sometimes friends were there. Sometimes one or two of his relatives from Poland would be visiting, and we would host them at the bishop's residence too, which I told Father Richard when we first began working, my house is your house, and feel free to have guests here. So,
why were reporters hand-selected for this news conference today?
Well, probably Kathy can answer that better than I can.
Well, I think we were going to have limited space, so we reached out to someone from each entity who we regularly interact with.
But wouldn't you leave it up to the media outlet to send their reporter of choice versus specifically asking for a reporter's name that you reserve?
Well, honestly, I think it really was that all of you who are here are people who I interact with on a regular basis, so we welcome you here and so glad you came.
We have a few more minutes.
What level of personal betrayal do you feel by this latest private audio recording being out?
Well, I have to tell you, Jay, it totally shocked me. I felt like I was hit by a bolt of lightning, kind of emotionally by it. It was the last thing in the world I ever expected or anticipated in my relationship with Father Richard. And so that's all I can say. I was just stunned by it and dismayed by it, and I just never saw it coming. So,
how do you interpret that? That he recorded meetings, apparently several, and then released them at this particular point in time when he's in peril, seemingly. How do you interpret that?
I don't even dare try to interpret it. I don't know what the dynamics of that might be, to tell you the truth. I don't have a sense. And he certainly hasn't talked to me about that. So I don't know how to answer the question. If I did, I'd give it a shot. But
can you truly say, with all that's happened, despite all of this that's transpired, that still the majority of Catholics have their faith behind you?
Well, I haven't taken a poll, but I get, believe it or not, you could ask my office staff, I get every week more positive mail, believe it, it sounds like I'm making this up, but I'm not, than I do negative mail. That comes too. But most of it is, I got two emails from people who are watching this whole thing, and they're intelligent people. They're committed to the church. They're distraught about this. And one woman said to me in an email, "I don't put you on a pedestal, okay?" She said, "I don't put anybody on a pedestal," but she said, "All of this is just too much." She meant, you know, the constant, the people who do play the drums for me to ride out of town. So, I mean, there are lots of people who kind of look at it with perspective, and that helps me a whole lot. I feel, to tell you the truth, and again, as I said, I'm not a masochist. I'm not a person who enjoys suffering and pain. And this is painful to me. Don't get me wrong. It's brought me closer to Christ in my prayer. And if you know me at all, I'm not a pietistic person. But it really has made me pray more deeply and feel more united with Christ, this whole situation. But, you know, I mean, if I really felt I couldn't do it, either physically or spiritually or emotionally, or that most of the Catholic people wanted me gone, then I'd have to look at it in a different way.
But as your legacy, as you said, if this is your last round of being a bishop, you retire out, why would you want this to be that part of your legacy as you leave the Catholic?
Because I'm here where I am now. We've all heard I suppose it's a cliche, the trite expression, bloom where you're planted. And I've had a very, very good ministry as a priest and then almost 20 years as a bishop. And I don't say this in any self-affirming way, but simply to point out I do have the respect of many of the U.S. bishops. I've been asked to take many leadership positions nationally. I've withdrawn from a couple of those now because I want to focus on our work at renewal and reform and purification. But I still, believe it or not, I still feel strong. I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, because I have moments when I don't feel strong. And that's when I talk to friends or I spend some time in the chapel. But I really believe, you know, Catholics believe, and many of you know this, that when we receive a sacrament, whether it's baptism or marriage or, in my case, holy orders, that a special grace from God comes with that sacrament. And I've never believed in that more deeply than I do right now, because I know my still being here is not just me. I know, I just trust that it's the Lord trying to help me through this thing, which is grueling. I'll admit that to you. Every day I wonder what's coming next.
Okay, one last question, Kim.
One last question for,
yes, Kim.
For the members of your flock who are still, they're waking up every day and maybe seeing the news just as you are. What words of strength or encouragement can you give them as they're reeling through this and happen?
Kim, thank you for a wonderful question. It's very simple to me, and my prayer tends to be very simple, if profound in another ways. My prayer for our people is that, first of all, they will keep a priority on praying for and working toward the healing of victims who have been abused by priests or anyone else, but primarily by priests and ministers of the church, number one. Number two, that they'll keep their focus on Jesus Christ, even though there's reason for disappointment with the church, not to give up, and to remember that even as we try to work through this terrible crisis that has hurt so many people in our world and in our own Western New York, that the larger mission of the church, which is to bring what Pope Francis calls the joy of the gospel to the world, that has to continue. I still have to be concerned that our youth and young adults receive good formation, good training in the faith, that our Catholic schools are doing what they should do, that we have outreach on the west side and elsewhere to our migrant and refugee families. All of those are the kind of the perennial mission of the church, and more. Of course, the worship of God is in there too, big time. And it's my responsibility, working with my priests and others, the laity and the religious and deacons, to make sure, even as we deal with a crisis situation now, that we're not losing sight of or commitment to that larger 2,000-year-old mission of the church that must go forward as we move into, I hope, new and better times.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you all.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for good questions.
Congressman Higgins wants you to resign.
Second time.
No credibility. After hearing these tapes, he says it's evidence that you let it.
Right.
You mentioned a dangerous priest.
Interesting, though. He's welcome to his opinion. Interesting that he feels it's okay for him as a politician to tell a religious figure to step down. If I, as a religious figure, told a politician to step down, we hear all about, you know, separation of church and state. True? I think so. He's welcome to his opinion.
But in a scandal of this nature, if a congressman was faced with this kind of a scandal, I would think more than just you would be asking him to resign.
Well, I wouldn't feel it was my, I might have a personal conversation, which I would have appreciated with Congressman Higgins. He wanted to come in and talk to me personally, which neither time he did. I would have welcomed him. Okay, thank you all. Thank you.